From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the congressman's lovely wife. Boy, was Connie Schultz tired of being introduced that way when her husband, Sherrod Brown, ran for a seat in the U.S. Senate, which he won. Schultz is a feminist and a Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper columnist used to speaking her mind, not just reflecting her husband's ideas. Her new memoir is about life in the role of the candidate's wife. Also, a conversation with our linguist Jeff Nunberg on the language of the presidential debates. We'll listen back to some key moments from the candidate sparring matches so far, including the YouTube debate. Jeff is the author of a book about the language of politics called Talking Right. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What's it like to be a candidate's wife and a feminist? That's what my guest Connie Schultz writes about in her new memoir, And His Lovely Wife. The title, of course, refers to the way she was often introduced at public events when she was seen as just an extension of him. Schultz was a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. When her husband, Democratic Congressman Sherrod Brown, decided to run for the Senate seat in Ohio. It was one of the closely watched Senate races in 2006. Brown and Schultz had been married a couple of years at the time. Schultz took a leave of absence from her paper during the campaign. Brown is now in the Senate. Schultz is back at her paper. They spend as much time together as they can, under the circumstances, and have residences in Ohio and Washington. Connie Schultz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You write in your book, I've spent all of my adult life as a feminist and a journalist, most recently as a newspaper columnist, sounding off, speaking my mind, giving my opinions. Yet when your husband was running for Senate, you had to say things like, well, Sherrod feels, well, Sherrod thinks, because it was all about like his opinion. What did you tell yourself when you had to adjust to that?
When I first started doing it, I told myself, Connie, you sound like every 16-year-old girlfriend you've ever met. I mean, it was such a challenge at times. And I don't mean that I wasn't proud of my husband. I was. I agree with Sherrod on most issues. You know, we've only been married for 3.5 years. You don't marry someone in middle age unless you have an awful lot in common, or you better not anyway. But I just couldn't quite believe what I was morphing into. And at first, I thought I'd lost all my edges. Do you know what I mean? I would look out there, and it was kind of like, who is this blurry person now going blah, 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 Sherrod Brown, blah, blah. But over time, I found my bearings, and I started to feel that I was coming back into view, just for myself, at least.
And what changed in how you were speaking or behaving that made you feel more like yourself?
Well, when I first started, I was really trying to just, you know, and I didn't even, I think, put enough thought into it. I was just parroting, Sherrod, people hand you these policy statements, or, you know, you talk about what, and after a while, I realized, it didn't take long, actually, that I was boring myself, so I could only imagine how the audience was feeling. And the whole reason for the book title is I felt like I even lost my name. I was just being introduced to Sherrod's wife a lot, and there was some issue over whether or not I should, well, not for me, I was never going to change my name, but particularly some men had a problem with my not having the same name as Sherrod. And then one night I was introduced at a chicken dinner as Sherrod Brown's wife, a woman who refuses to change her name, so here she is. So he didn't even say my name. And at the same time, I had just lost my father to a heart attack. My dad died about 2 weeks earlier, and it really all came to a head for me. And I thought, you know, saying that I haven't changed my name because I only married Sherrod a year and a half ago doesn't begin to explain why I have this name and why I'm proud of it. And so I got up, and it was a working class crowd. And so I talked about my working class parents, my mom and my dad, and what they'd given up in their lives. They both died in their 60s. I talked about how they wore their bodies out so their kids would never have to, and how, you know, they thought they were two nobodies. Jane and Chuck Schultz, they thought they were two nobodies their entire lives, but they were going to raise four somebodies. And so I talked about why I'm so proud of this name. And this is why I have the name Schultz. And the man who introduced me came up and he had tears in his eyes. He was an older man. He said, I love the name Schultz. Don't ever change the name Schultz. But more importantly for me, I realized I really felt like I was back.
You write in your book that being opinionated made you, quote, your basic nightmare as a political wife, not to mention for any political consultant. What was the advice that consultants were giving you about how you should express opinions and how independent you should or should not seem to be?
That got nipped in the bud fairly quickly, the whole concept that they were just simply going to tell me unsolicited what they thought I ought to be doing. And I do remember fairly early in the campaign, two men started talking about, you need to do this, you need to do that. And I just looked at them and I said, you know what? Never mistake yourselves for people who give me orders. Because that's not how this is going to work. And it really helps to be so close to 50, doesn't it, Terry? Because, you know, just things start coming out of you that you never thought you had, at least for me. And so very early, I think I determined that I wasn't going to change who I am. I quit wearing tailored suits pretty quickly because I felt like I was getting sawed in half by the end of the day. Because, you know, you're riding in a car a lot of the day. And I started wearing more flowing clothes that I was used to wearing. And the other thing was I had a book come out in the middle of the campaign full of my opinions. It was a collection of my columns. And there was a lot of hand-wringing at first. Oh, what are they going to use against us? They never touched it. And I can tell you, I know why. It's because women would never have trucked it. Women were not going to put up with me or any other woman getting attacked for having her own views, especially when I had been paid to give my opinion.
What are some of the rules as you think they have been written for being a political wife? And what are some of those rules that you feel you followed or knowingly broke?
The traditional view of political spouses, which is just confounding to me, is that you're either a prop or a problem. And one of the interesting things that's happened since the book has come out is I'm getting emails from women whose husbands are running for elected office. And they are saying things to me like, wow, you don't seem to have taken the advice that I've been given. And one woman said they told me to wear a lot of beige. Where does that come from? Where do they get this stuff? And I tell them, look, all I can tell you is I had a whole book of my opinions come out. I was so conny in that book. And Sherrod won by almost 13 points. And I'm not saying that I helped him win, but it sure didn't hurt him to have a real person in his life. And so I just couldn't abide by this notion that I was just supposed to stand there and look at my husband with this incredible look of adoration on my face. I do adore my husband. I love him. This hearing the same speech time after time after time, it's been kind of amusing to watch the coverage of Bill Clinton. Can he sit still? Can he not look bored? Can he, you know, can he not be the one talking? And I just thought, welcome to spousedom, Bill. We've been going through this for a very long time. And I don't, yeah, you look at Elizabeth Edwards and how outspoken she is now, and you look at the various candidates' wives, I think they're starting to get the idea that they are supposed to be themselves. Michelle Obama certainly is herself. That playbook, I don't know who wrote it. I suspect it had very little input from women, and it's time to throw it out.
There's usually an inherent friction between politicians and the journalists who cover them. Journalists mm-hmm. often feel the politicians spin, sometimes lie, yeah. often exaggerate. Politicians feel that they're misrepresented by the press, that the press wants to go after private things that shouldn't be public, and that the press takes things out of context and puts them out of proportion. So did you have any reservations as a journalist about getting into a romantic relationship and then a marriage with a politician because of this inherent friction?
I had all kinds of reasons for being hesitant about being involved with an elected official. I'd never, ever dated one. I had never covered Sherrod or interviewed him, or I would never have gone out with him. He hates when I say that, but it's true. You know, it's so I had all kinds of reservations. There were tensions when we were dating at first because he would like to give me lectures on the mainstream media, and you can imagine how much fun that was. And I would, you know, immediately respond, "Well, you want us when you need us, and then you hate that you need us, and you go after us." But it was never my concern was never about the coverage in terms of being involved with Sherrod. My concern was simply making sure that everyone was on. How do I say this? I knew these were my opinions. They've always been my opinions. I anticipated, and as it turned out, it did happen occasionally, only by men, though. I've never had a woman journalist ever ask me, can I still do my job with Sherrod in the Senate? Could I still do my job if I was married to an elected official? No women ever doubt these are my opinions. That was more my concern about being involved with Sherrod. And in terms of when he was running, I knew I was going to have to take a leave of absence, and I was worried about what I could return to for a while there. As I've said many times to people who make observations now about my life, I'm the same person I always was. My life is very different.
How controversial was it at your paper, The Cleveland Plain Dealer, about whether you should or shouldn't give up your column for the duration of your husband's political campaign?
Well, nobody was suggesting that I should at The Plain Dealer, actually. I made that decision on my own. I mean, we certainly had a conversation early that once the campaign picked up, and if I needed to be on the campaign trail, then of course I was going to have to take a leave of absence. But this decision was all mine. It came sooner than I had originally expected. But you know what? Ethics, so much of ethics is about perception and avoiding even the perception of an ethical conflict. And that's where I found myself landing pretty quickly. I was limiting myself more and more on my topics to avoid any appearance of parroting my husband. And in the newsroom, I felt I was losing a whole circle of friends, not permanently, but I couldn't talk to them the way I used to because I had gone from being a colleague to a source. I mean, we all had to acknowledge that. And I also felt, at least at our paper, that some of my colleagues, and I absolutely understand this, were bending over backwards to show they weren't biased. And so our paper was the only paper in the state really hammering Sherrod on a regular basis.
Did being a journalist affect how you spoke to the press during your husband's Senate campaign? And let me say a couple of things about this. As a journalist, I'm sure you want people to be forthcoming to you, and therefore you might mm-hmm. have felt a responsibility to be as forthcoming with yes. journalists when you were interviewed. At the same time, being a journalist, you know that things can be taken out of context. Mm-hmm. And so how did being a journalist affect how you spoke to the press?
Well, you know, I just had a reporter say this to me the other day who covered the race. He was interviewing me for C-SPAN, and he said, you know, you didn't make it easy because you'd come up and you immediately wanted to talk shop. And I did. You know, I'm a newsroom animal, and I really missed being at a newspaper. So my relationship with the press was different, I suspect, from a lot of spouses. They were, overwhelmingly very respectful of me. I never fudged in my answers to them. They didn't interview me a lot, to be honest with you. There wasn't a lot of that going on. Perhaps they had their priorities straight and Sherrod was a running. I think they're also, you know, especially small town reporters would admit to being a little intimidated. Not by me personally, I think, just by, you know, I work at the largest paper in the state. So, and I did not know this at the time, but apparently Sherrod was like, was really enjoying reminding reporters that I was writing a book about the race. And I heard from a reporter the other day that said, you know, you made an awful lot of us really nervous sometimes. I had no idea that was going on.
Did you make any gaffes in speaking to the press?
You know, I think there's one, I cite it in the book, that there were a couple reporters who for a while were convinced that Sherrod was an angry man. I don't know if you've ever heard Sherrod speak, but he's got a very growly voice. And some people think that he's an angry guy, I guess. And these reporters were convinced of that. They were, you know, one of the things I saw as a problem with a lot of political reporters is they tend to be overwhelmingly white, middle-aged men who've been doing this a lot. Now, I love middle-aged white men. I happen to be married to one. But if that's who's covering races for the most part, you've got a problem because it's the only perspective you're getting. And they tend to be very cynical. Sherrod got in a race, gave up a safe house seat to run. And as crazy as it may sound to some people, he really just thought he needed to try this. It was the time. And if he didn't do it, he'd always regret it. So I'm trying to dispel this idea, this notion that Sherrod is angry. And so I talk about this ping pong table that I gave him for our anniversary. It was our second anniversary. And I keep pointing out that no reporter really lauded me for letting him have it in the living room for the whole season. But I did, Terry. It was right there in our living room. And I talked about how we would play after a long drive or when he had a lot on his mind. We'd just play ping pong for a bit. You know, 1 o'clock in the morning, we're playing ping pong, just kind of sorting things out. Well, apparently, the way I described it, and I talked about how he would pretend to jump the fence when he won, which was always, you know, and he'd pretend to imitate the roar of the crowd. And because, you know, he's competitive and he was making me laugh. They read that to mean that even when he's playing ping pong, he's angry. And that when he's playing ping pong, he thinks of the Iraq War and whack, he hits the ball. And when he's thinking about Americans with no health care, whack, he hits the ball. I never said that. And it was the lead of the story. And that was really an education for me because I thought, well, you can have the best of intentions. You can say exactly what you meant and it can be interpreted differently.
My guest is Connie Schultz. Her new memoir is called And His Lovely Wife. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Connie Schultz. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Her new book is a memoir about her experiences on the campaign trail when her husband, then-Congressman Sherrod Brown, was running for Senate, and he did win, and he's now serving in the Senate. Her memoir is called And His Lovely Wife, because that's how she was often introduced. When your husband, Sherrod Brown, was running for the U.S. Senate from Ohio, And you were on the campaign trail with him, you know, a good deal of the time. Did it get you to reconsider where the line is between public and private for politicians and their spouses?
I'm still wrestling with that one, to be honest with you. I've seen some recent coverage that, you know, I keep thinking and rethinking it. But I do think, bottom line, I just had someone ask me the other day about a particular instance and should the press be covering this? And I said, you know, you can't hold yourself out publicly as one person and be someone else privately. I mean, you just cannot. If you are like that, you deserve to be outed. And I think a lot of politicians and their families thought I was going to come out and say, the press goes way too far. And I think occasionally the press certainly do go too far. But I think your public life is open for scrutiny, and that's just the way it's going to be. And you have, you know, there's a good rule of thumb to live your life by. Don't do anything you wouldn't want to read about on page one.
Did you feel like, well, what if they found out that I did fill in the blank when I was in college?
I was so boring in college, Terry. I never worried so much about that. You know what you worry about more? You worry about what people can make up And I saw that on blogs. I mean, people can just make up stuff and it gets traction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you worry about more, I think, anyways, that you ought to worry about. How do we dog those rumors? And how do we make the people who spread them accountable when they go by names like Red Dog Daddy or Lizard Lung? I mean, who are these people? And they're saying these horrible things about you. And then all of a sudden reporters are asking because they've read it on a blog. That worries me far more.
Isn't the sad truth that a lot of people are going to judge what you have to say more on your hair than the policy you're talking about?
Well, we're certainly seeing that
right
now.
I'm not endorsing this, but
I know you're not.
It's just it's kind of the way it is sometimes.
I think we got to push back on it. And I'll confess, this disappoints me more as a feminist when it's women writing this stuff. And I just don't, you know, I've finally decided to make my peace with that. It does bother me more. I want us to be better than this. I want our journalism to be better than this. So I'm just going to start talking about it more as I go around and do the journalism seminars and give the speeches that I give. I'm going to talk about one of the things I wanted. You know, I wanted more women journalists working because I thought we would elevate the coverage. So let's get cracking.
And that said, let me just like bring it down a notch or two. how did you deal with things like having your hair look good when you were on the road and completely exhausted and just really mentally fatigued too? Because you knew that you're going to be on stage and you're going to be on TV and all that.
Oh, this is so embarrassing. All right, Terry, I'll tell you. I bought a pack of traveling rollers, electric rollers. And I went from a woman who would never be seen in a bathrobe in public or anything to walking around houses of people I just met with electric rollers in my hair, mm-hmm. talking to them as I'm putting on makeup. You know, you just lose all sense of parameters in terms of what you're willing to let people see, because you figure if they're opening their home up for an hour or something, letting you get cleaned up, you can trust them. And if you can't, well, what's the worst thing they're going to say about me? Boy, does she look awful in rollers. Well, who doesn't, right? So I felt like I was back in small town Ashtabula, where I grew up, where everybody used to walk around in rollers on Saturday morning so they'd be ready for Saturday night. That the only thing missing were the fuzzy slippers in the bathrobe. So you do learn tricks of the trade, and you tell yourself, I can't believe I've been reduced to this. But you know, you see enough pictures of yourself looking like you just came out of, you know, the tumble dry, and you think you better do something to make it, you know, it's bizarre.
Well, it's the part of politics that's show business, you know, where
you're
going to be on stage and you got to put on the makeup and the wig if you're, you know, I mean, that's what they would do in the theaters, you know, put on the wig and the costume and and so on. All right. Okay, we're done with that.
Are you happy that I answered
we're
that,
done.
Terry? That better not be a blog title. She wore electric rollers during campaign.
Now, let me change the mood completely here for a moment.
Sure.
During your husband's Senate campaign, your father died.
Yeah.
And as he was dying, or maybe it was after he died, you said to your husband, stay in Washington. There was a very important congressional vote, and you wanted him to be there for that vote. And reading that, I kept thinking how difficult it must have been for you to say that. And I'd really like to hear why you gave your husband that advice and what your thought process was like.
Okay. Well, I was actually on my book tour, but I was in Ohio. I was down in southern Ohio, and Cleveland's up north, where my dad, you know, lived near Cleveland, and he had had a heart attack at 69. And my sister, Leslie, called and left a frantic message, and they've tried to revive him. They've gone out, they're rushing him to university hospitals, but and then my brother called, it's not looking good, you better get up here. And my dad was unresponsive, and he never came back. For 2 days, he was on life support. And it was really, really hard. I can't adequately convey how difficult it was. And I'm trying to help I'm just trying to coordinate everything. And Shara keeps calling, and Shara says, do you want me to come home? And of course, I would love for him to be there. I mean, as I wrote in the book, the only thing I wanted more was for my dad to come back to life. But there were some votes on intelligence votes. And I knew that if Sherrod missed those, within days, we would see another attack ad about how Sherrod is supposedly soft on terrorism. And so I said to him, and it was partly selfish on my part, of course I don't want my husband to miss the votes. I don't want these ads. I also don't want to hear him explaining. You know, this happened in April. I didn't want to have to listen to him explain for the next few months that the reason he wasn't there was because his father-in-law was dying. I just thought, I'm not going to be able to do this. People will look for my response every time he says it. It was so close to the surface for me, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't want to put myself through that. So I think it was the right thing to do. It was very hard for Sherrod, but it was absolutely the right thing to do. And what I told myself, you know, I was a single mom for 11 years. I was used to having to take care of everything. And marrying a member of Congress, and especially marrying a candidate, certainly was no guarantee that I wouldn't still feel like a single mother sometimes. And you talk to members' wives, especially those of young children, they feel that way a lot. What was, even after all that, Dad died after 2 days, and Cher did come back and was one of the pallbearers. And what was really hard for my daughter, this is one of those campaign moments you just can't forget, at least in our family, is we buried my dad 2 days after he died. We drive home, and somebody had gotten into our driveway and put a Bush bumper sticker over the, I had two bumper stickers on my car. I had Sherrod's, but I also had one that's still on. I have always had, and I always have it over my desk. Well-behaved women rarely make history. And somebody put a Bush sticker over that, so it felt particularly pointed. And my daughter was so upset, and my daughter's 20, and she said, Mom, couldn't they have left us alone today? Because it was in the paper that my dad had died. Plain Joe had asked me to do a column about his death, and I came back for that. And I turned to her and I said, honey, there is no respite from a campaign. It's always going on. And I think I was realizing it at the same moment that I was communicating that to my daughter.
Connie Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Her new memoir is called And His Lovely Wife. It's about life on the campaign trail in 2006 while her husband, Sherrod Brown, ran for his seat in the Senate. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why Connie Schultz had to hide her garbage. And we look at some of the language landmines in the presidential debates with our linguist, Jeff Nunberg. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Connie Schultz. Her new memoir, And His Lovely Wife, is about her experiences as a political candidate's wife. In 2006, her husband, Sherrod Brown, then a Democratic congressman from Ohio, successfully campaigned for a seat in the U.S. Senate. Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. There were some really obnoxious and kind of dirty things that went on during the campaign. One example that stands out in my mind, you were looking at your window one day and saw two guys in suits run out of their car and take your trash and put it.
Tried to take it. I stopped them, too.
Oh, you
I
stopped
screamed
them.
Like a banshee. I stopped them.
What did you
them,
do?
Yes. I screamed, and my pug standing next to me, who's half blind and partially deaf, was barking so loudly that she only had one paw touching the ground. I mean, we really made a ruckus. But that was exactly 2 weeks after Sherrod declared that he was running. And, you know, they pulled up. We had just moved into this neighborhood. And at first I thought, wow, they really do garbage differently. They wear suits and they pick up the trash. And then I realized that it's a white van. It's unmarked. And they keep looking around as they're picking them up. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, oh, my God, they're stealing our trash. So I opened the door and I started. It was a very ladylike moment for me. Get away from my trash. And it just hit me. You know, and I think because I was so much on edge at that moment anyway, it's like, oh, my God, what are we doing to our lives? How much is my life going to change? What's this going to do to our marriage? And the guys are stealing our trash already. I felt like I was starring in a really bad B movie. It was just, it was bad.
So did you ever find out who they were?
No. Nope. All I could tell you is we had a lot of trash pile up in our garage. And the night before the election, our trash is picked up on Monday nights. Sherrod and I took out a ton of trash and just left it on the tree lawn. And it felt so great. How silly does that sound?
So you had, you had to hide your trash during most of the campaign. And
yeah, we either took it somewhere else or, well, you know, we weren't home a lot. So we didn't have as much as we would have had if we'd been living out of our home every day. All the paper stuff had to be shredded. And it wasn't like we thought we had anything to hide. Again, it goes to what can people make up about you? Do you know what I mean? And plus, it's just unseemly, the thought of somebody going through your personal trash. But it was so liberating that night to just dump it all there on the tree lawn. And then we just walked back to the house. And, you know, it was almost over. And we were so aware in that moment. So much was almost over.
You know, you describe yourself as a feminist. So standing back and looking at the time that you spent on the campaign trail, you know, being, the spouse of the of the candidate and meeting men and women and being introduced so often as and his lovely wife, how far do you feel like we've come, you know what I mean, as women in in the larger society? I mean, I think a lot of women are in jobs and have friends and family where feminism is just, whether you use the word or not, it's just kind of taken for granted. I mean, it's just assumed that women are equal and so on. But that's not always the case in the larger society in America. So were you pleased or disappointed in that area with what you found?
I was disappointed. There's no question I was disappointed. Washington's been a huge adjustment for me because I can be anywhere else in the country now, especially as, you know, I have this new book, I write my column, and I, first and foremost, what I do for a living, except in Washington, where I am the senator's wife. And when we had Senate orientation, one of the things that we Wise would like to change for next time is we do have a demonstration on how we can order Senate China. And that's just so offensive to me when you think of all that's going on in the world and all the problems that our newly elected husbands were going to be tackling. I also have become much more outspoken about talking about how I'm a feminist because women are often, especially younger women, are afraid of the word. And I keep telling them being a feminist never meant figuring out who you could neglect. I love my family. I love my husband. I, you know, packed his lunches and made sure his shirts were ironed. That didn't make me less of a feminist because it was about choices. And it's about women being able to make various choices for their lives. But what was heartening, and this was in Ohio, and it surprised me, is how many times I was invited to speak to a group of women. And it would be standing room only, not because of me personally. Most of them didn't even know who I was at that point. But they had heard that there was this woman out there who was really outspoken and her husband wasn't reining her in. And they would come and they would tell me their stories. And one of the interesting things about it is more and more women were organizing their own political groups in Ohio because they got tired, as one woman put it, being asked to make coffee and do the Xeroxing at Democratic headquarters in her county. And the women thought, well, we'll just form our own group. And they were raising money, sometimes outraising the traditional party in terms of money for campaigns. And they were women my age and older, for the most part. Not a lot of young women. These were women who, at an age where we're supposedly supposed to become invisible in our country because we're not real young anymore and we aren't procreating at a furious rate. And they were making change in the country. They were deciding that they were a viable force for change and they were no longer going to be ignored. And in that way, I'm increasingly encouraged. Probably my biggest disappointment at times is with younger women, but I do hear them when they say that my generation of women hasn't been particularly supportive of them. And I keep reminding women my age, look, we don't have their midriffs, but they don't have our wisdom. And there is a trade-off. And we really need to carry as we climb.
Connie Schultz, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Connie Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Her new memoir is called And His Lovely Wife. Coming up, we talk with our linguist Jeff Nunberg about the language of the presidential debates. This is Fresh Air. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been following the presidential debates, listening to what the candidates have to say and what language they're using to say it. Jeff is the author of a book about political language called Talking Right, which has just come out in paperback. It analyzes the political vocabulary of the right and the left. Jeff teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. He chairs the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. Well, hi, Jeff. Welcome back to the show. As a linguist, what are you listening for, and what have been your general impressions as you listen to the debates?
Well, you know, my real impression as I listen to the debates is mostly stupefaction. The other day after the Democratic debate in Iowa, I played about four or five of these things that I had had taped all together. It was like listening to a marathon of Last Comic Standing. You get one after another of these questions that really are not designed to elicit anything like a nuanced or insightful discussion of the issues, and these 30-second responses or show of hand. You know, do you have a gun in your house? Raise your hand. Tell us about your personal God. What decisive moment shaped your character? My daughter and I spent an hour on that one while she was doing her college application the other day. So if you listen to these at great length, you might feel that as far as advancing the democratic process, they're not very informative. At the same time, you do get a sense, I think, both of the individual candidates and of the kind of language that's going to be crucial in 2008 in determining how the country falls out.
Are you hearing shifts in how the candidates, Republicans and Democrats, are talking about the war in Iraq?
Oh, yeah. From both, but more from the Democrats a bit, but from the Republicans, too. This began really with the 2006 elections. The history of this administration's involvement in Iraq, in a sense, if you look back on it, you could think of as a series of linguistic miscues and slogan recalls, I think of them. So one after another, wanted dead or alive, morphed into we don't know where he is and we really don't care. And of course, there was mission accomplished just after the Iraq invasion, which I'm sure the administration wished immediately almost that it could take back and replace with something a little more non-committal, like way to go or something like that. There was bring them on. There was when they stand up, we'll stand down, and so on. And finally, in the fall of 2006, there's Bush saying, we've never been stay the course, which gave all of the news outlets, including Fox, an opportunity to run lots of clips of Bush saying exactly that. Now, if you listen to the Republican debates, you still hear people talking in those terms. Don't stampede for the exit signs. We've got to support the troops and so on. But those comments are aimed largely at a Republican base that's going to be determine who wins in the primaries. And it's not clear whether that has any more purchase with the larger electorate. And one thing that's significant, for example, is that the Democrats, who are talking about withdrawing, and there's really a question of just when. Is it going to be immediately? Is it going to be 9 months? Is it going to be 12 months? And so on, are not defensive about that and don't need to make a show of saying we support the troops. In fact, when they bring that up, it's only by way of justifying their votes to continue funding the war. So there's a sense, if you listen to both sides, of an acknowledgement, implicit or not, that the voters are very much troubled about the war and that public opinion has shifted against the war.
Jeff, do you have a clip you can play of something that struck you as an interesting rhetorical style in talking about the war in Iraq?
Yeah, when you listen to the way the Republicans in particular talk about the war, there's this effort, most notably from Giuliani, but also from McCain and Romney and most of the other candidates, to defocus Iraq and make this more a question of the struggle against terrorism, or as the Republicans are continually putting it, Islamic terrorism. Here's Giuliani, for example, faulting the Democrats for not talking about Islamic terrorism.
In four Democratic debates, not a single Democratic candidate said the word Islamic terrorism. Now, that is taking political correctness to extremes. It really is.
So now, the reality is
that you do not achieve peace through weakness and appeasement. Weakness and appeasement should not be a policy of the American government. We should seek a victory in Iraq and in Baghdad, and we should define the victory. And I thought the piece by O'Hanlon and Pollock last week in the New York Times, which I have to frankly tell you, when I read it in the morning, I read it twice, and I checked New York Times, but it was the New York Times. It was. And it said, we just might win in Iraq. Now, why we would want to retreat in the face of at least some empirical evidence that General Petraeus...
But that's military progress, no political progress. You'd continue to support the surge even if there's no political progress.
The reality is that if we can bring stability to Iraq and we can give them a chance to develop stability, that's what we should be trying to accomplish. This is part of an overall terrorist war against the United States. And that's why I noted Senator McCain's statement.
Jeff, what else do you hear in that clip that stands out for you in terms of the language that Giuliani's using?
Well, on the one hand, there's clearly an appeal to that part of the Republican base, the people who'll be voting in the primaries, who still think that we have to stay the course and hold out for victory in Iraq. On the other hand, what's going to be more interesting, I think, particularly in the general election, is this continuing effort to make the war in Iraq seem, as Giuliani puts it, part of an overall terrorist war against the United States, and in particular an Islamic terrorist war against the United States. And in a sense, this continues the neoconservative line on what this struggle's about.
In your book, Talking Right, you analyze the language of the left and the right. Are you hearing coded language in the presidential debates? And if so, what are some of the linguistic battlefields?
Yeah, I think it's clearest, for example, when you listen to the way people talk about health insurance. Everybody agrees this is a problem. And while the Republicans are still saying we have the greatest system of health care in the world, they're, at least the front runners, are not denying that there are problems and that have to be resolved. Now, when you listen to the Democrats talk about it, you hear this, well, I guess it's sort of a revived populist language. People are talking about special interest, entrenched interest, insurance companies lining the pockets of big business. These are the phrases you're hearing, not just from Obama and Edwards, but from Clinton as well. They're talking tough on trade and job outsourcing and rising inequality and so on. The Republicans don't, for example, ever talk about insurance companies or pharmaceutical companies. Those phrases are just about absent from the debates. What they do talk about is market-based solutions. Or market solutions. The idea being, in that way of thinking of things, as well, is the market and the government, and these are these two opposing ways of thinking about things. And what they're trying to do is retain this old sense of the government as demonized. That's worked very well for the Republicans since the Reagan years. Really, it was Reagan, although it had been around before that, who established this idea: government is part of the problem, not part of the solution. The scariest words in the English language are "I'm from the government and I'm here to help," and so on. So that Republicans evoke government, that word, as a kind of boogeyman, and are hoping that in so doing they can retain a market-based approach. Now, whether that will still work is hard to know. The role of government is going to be a crucial issue in the 2008 elections and going forward. Whether the Republican rhetoric can be maintained. For instance, the Republicans continue to talk about socialized medicine. Tancredo even talks about womb-to-tomb medical care. That's a phrase I thought had died out in 1973. Whether that still has the power as a specter to frighten the American people remains to be seen, because there is an increasing concern about government's failure to deliver in Katrina, on health care, with regard to infrastructure, pensions and retirement, and so on. And that's really, I think, where the struggle between left and right is going to be fought out, both substantively and linguistically, over the coming years.
Jeff, do you think the so-called values issues are the issues where language, political language, is most loaded? And I'm thinking about issues like abortion, gay marriage. And are you hearing as much about those issues, and are you hearing, you know, loaded or coded language in discussing those issues?
You're hearing that in among the Republicans in these catfights over who was pro-life when and how pro-life is Romney and what did he sign when he was governor of Massachusetts. And this will certainly come up with Giuliani over the course of the campaign. You hear, I think, less of them than you would have certainly in 2004. The the issue, for instance, of don't ask, don't tell, when the Republicans are asked about that, their answer tends to be, well, this isn't the time to bring this up. We're in the middle of a war and so on. So they avoid the question on tactical grounds rather than on grounds of principle. The Democrats at the same time, they all appeared in the Logo Network to address issues of interest to gay and lesbian Americans. Apart from Kucinich, they all declared strong support for civil unions and expressed reservations about gay marriage. But these aren't going to be in the primaries, at least, strong issues, evidently, apart from abortion, perhaps, among the Republicans. Whether they'll emerge in 2008 in the general elections as important issues remains to be seen. My sense is they're going to be less important than they have been in the last few issues, last few elections, partly because the war is so important, and partly because economic concerns are beginning to become equally important to Americans.
Jeff, in your book, Talking Right, you suggested that Democrats should learn from the Republicans and adopt a new populist language. Do you hear that happening in the debates?
Yeah, I think you hear that happening actually from before the debates. You could hear it certainly in a lot of the 2006 senatorial campaigns. Tester in Montana, Webb in Virginia, Casey in Pennsylvania, Klobuchar in Minnesota, Sherrod Brown in Ohio, certainly. Now, some of these people were described as centrist or conservative Democrats because of their positions on social issues, Tester and Webb, for example. But all of them were arguing a very strong case for economic populism. And I think the fact that they were identified at the time as conservative Democrats is an indication of how the liberal conservative distinctions sorted out now, so that your position on abortion, say, is to people much more important in determining whether you're a liberal or a conservative than your position, say, on health care. But I think that the increased concern over these issues, the increased use of this populist language, and not the populist language of the Republicans, but the sort of truly populist language or historically populist language in any event, is a sign perhaps that that distinction is being redefined in more in its traditional terms around economic issues than around social issues, so that issues like health care, education, pensions, and so on become more crucial in deciding who's a liberal and who's a conservative than questions like abortion and gun control.
My guest is our linguist, Jeff Nunberg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air's linguist, Jeff Nunberg. We're talking about the language of the presidential debates. His book about the language of politics has just come out in paperback. It's called Talking Right. Now, you wrote that conservatives had managed to move the center of gravity of American political language to the right. Do you hear any shift in that while you listen to the presidential debates?
Well, it's too early to say. The after the 2004 elections in particular, there was this great concern among the Democrats about having lost the framing wars and needing to reframe and remessage and so forth. A lot of that was just about the Republicans' skill at framing bumper stickers. No Child Left Behind, Clear Skies, Healthy Forests, things like that. I think the lesson of the 2006 elections, particularly with regard to the war, but with regard to other things in addition, is that bumper stickers only take you so far. I think the Republicans' real advantage has been in their ownership of notions like values, tradition, bias is an important term, and their ability to stigmatize the liberal label itself. And those are linguistic advantages that come not just from using the words, but from building the words into a set of very powerful narratives. At this point, it isn't clear yet whether the Democrats are going to be able to redress that balance by creating narratives of their own and language that stands for it. Right now, though the Democrats enjoy an advantage, certainly because of general dissatisfaction with the war and with the administration, there isn't yet the sense that the Democratic Party stands for something in the way there is that the Republican Party stands for something, and that still is something they're going to have to redress.
You mentioned that the word liberal has been stigmatized. Hillary Clinton, in one of the debates, this was in the YouTube debate, she was asked by one of the YouTubers if she was a liberal. Let's hear a clip of that, and then I'd be interested in hearing what you thought of her response to this question.
Hi, my name is Rob Porter, and I'm from Irvine, California. I have a question for Hillary Clinton. Mrs. Clinton, how would you define the word liberal? And would you use this word to describe yourself? Thank you.
No, Rob. You know, it is a word that originally meant that you were for freedom, that you were for the freedom to achieve, that you were willing to stand against big power and on behalf of the individual. Unfortunately, in the last 30, 40 years, it has been turned up on its head, and it's been made to seem as though it is a word that describes big government, totally contrary to what its meaning was in the 19th and early 20th century. I prefer the word progressive, which has a real American meaning, going back to the progressive era at the beginning of the 20th century. I consider myself a modern progressive, someone who believes strongly in individual rights and freedoms, who believes that we are better as a society when we're working together, and when we find ways to help those who may not have all the advantages in life get the tools they need to lead a more productive life for themselves and their families. So,
Jeff, do you hear that as a clue that Democrats are trying to substitute the word progressive for the word liberal because the word liberal has been stigmatized?
Oh, sure. Democrats have been trying to do that for a long time. And if anybody can make it happen, I suppose it's Hillary Clinton. They've, given how the word liberal has been trashed and loaded with all these invidious stereotypes, they want to revive this progressive label going back, as Clinton suggests, to the beginning of the 20th century, or some people take it back to 1948 and Henry Wallace and the progressive campaigns. And there's a set, when I see this, I think of what the Ford Motor Company tried to do in 1960 when the Edsel line kind of collapsed, and they stopped they stopped making Edsel cars, but they continued to make some of the same cars, only branded them as a Galaxy, and they did very well for a number of years on the assumption that nobody would notice it was the same car. And you sometimes have that sense about the progressive label. And if you abandon the liberal label, as Clinton and a lot of other Democrats would like to do, you basically hand it over to the Republicans and the right to define. One interesting side note to this is that, in fact, if you look at polls, for the first time in about 25 years, the number of people who call themselves liberals in America is actually going up. It isn't yet even with the number of people who describe themselves as conservatives, but it's gone up substantially after about 25 years of being under 20%.
You've been watching all of the debates. Do you see them as actual debates? I mean, when you know, like, do you see them as being, you know, traditional debates, the way the word debate used to mean?
No, they have nothing to do with debates in the traditional sense. Not only are they nothing that a high school or college debating team would recognize, but they really don't have a lot to do with this effort to lay out and explore the issues in any detail. The whole system militates against that, and the way they're done, the triviality of the questions, the effort to create these gotcha moments to set up little confrontations between the candidates and so on, all are aimed at anything but a serious exploration of the issues. And it may be that just modern American televised politics isn't capable of doing that, and that's the one thing you can hope that ultimately the internet or new technologies will be able to supply, but that isn't clear either.
No, it's maybe heading in the other way,
right,
isn't it? In some ways, because the internet is where all the gaffes are spread.
The internet,
embarrassing moments.
Yeah. Right. Your macaca moment is instantly out on YouTube. And also with the internet, you basically can live your entire life without encountering anybody whose politics are remotely different from yours.
Well, Jeff, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Terry.
Jeff Nunberg is Fresh Air's linguist. His book about the language of politics, Talking Right, has just come out in paperback. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Social Intelligence, The New Science of Human Relationships by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. And from MGM, presenting Death at a Funeral, a comedy about romance, scandal, and mystery. From Frank Oz, the director of Bowfinger, in theaters August 17th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, NPR's Baghdad bureau chief Jamie Tarabay. Long before she was a war correspondent, she spent nights in bomb shelters. Her family lived in Lebanon during the Syrian bombings. She's been covering Iraq since December 2005. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.